In our latest Create Conversation, Nation's Restaurant News spoke with Mike Leonard, CEO and founder of Talk Korean, Alex Wu, founder of Fouled Up, and Young Zhao, founder of Gen Z. In this conversation filmed in Denver during Create, the three discussed why Chinese food is so cheap, the opportunities in Asian food, how to begin franchising, the cost of labor, and more. Now I'm going to throw it over to these three for this really interesting interview.
My name is Alex Wu. So we have a restaurant concept called Bowed Up. We specialize in Chinese steamed bun and a lot of other things. We started back in 2017 with our first restaurant. Now we have three restaurants. And we're located in Austin, Texas.
Hi, my name is Yong. I was born in China, and I have two concepts, actually. One is a Chinese fast casual, a Chinese version of Chipotle, three green, what it's called. So Jin's Kitchen, it's in New York and New Haven, Connecticut area. And then we have a new concept called Nice Day Chinese. It's a concept we basically buy out Chinese takeout, renovating into basically 21st century level of Chinese takeout. With more automation and information technology. That's a brief introduction.
Hi, my name is Mike Leonard. I started Talk Korean Taco Grill in 2010 in a food truck in Washington, D.C. Since then, we grew into a small, fast, casual restaurant, as many as five locations. And now we are looking to do franchising as well, in addition to growing company-owned stores this year. Our food is Korean style tacos, but also Salvadorian style, kind of Mexican style twist, in addition to a lot of rice bowls and salads. So
what is it like, you know, being in charge of a restaurant? I mean, that's a big responsibility. What is it like being the head of any of these concepts? Any of you can take this question.
You want to take
it? I can go for it.
Yeah, go for it. Go first.
I mean, yeah, restaurant business is a very broad concept, which means the restaurant business of a billion-dollar company, restaurant business, small business, right? It depends on what kind of company you're targeting for. Like if you have to shape a company to that way or shape yourself to that way. So what I do is I take Chinese restaurant as one of the biggest opportunity in the U.S. market right now, because the majority of Chinese restaurant owners, they are in this immigrant labor families, and they are retiring from the business. So Chinese restaurant in the past 5 years retired. We lost about 30% net loss of units in Chinese restaurant. Part of due to COVID, but also the majority problem is because their kids grow up, doesn't want to come back, and there are no new Chinese poor laborers. China is not that poor anymore. So Chinese restaurant is probably the largest ethnic food without even a major penetration for like mainstream labor force. It basically depends on ethnic labors. So that's the largest like opportunity. That's probably $3 billion opportunities. So what my company is targeting for is become a public company. Right now, there are no public Chinese food companies in the U.S. It's interesting. So that means that we have to shape a company in that way to become these fast-growing company, be able to expand fast and grow fast, grow big. So that I'm not in the restaurant most of the time because I have my team member take care of the restaurants. My job's more on the product design, business development, fundraising of stuff, product stuff. So it's a bit different from like the early stage when I was in the restaurant. Make sure every food is came up right, design the recipes, and I work with team members to make sure everything works out. So now my job changed a lot, basically.
That evolution is like the whole mindset that I'm constantly thinking about, right? Like the first couple of years when you're serving all the food, making all the food, teaching everybody the standards. Then there's the second round where maybe you have two units, three units, and you still kind of work some shifts. Maybe you cover people's vacation. Maybe you go in when someone's sick, but you have some store management. But the store management, they're good, but they're not quite there yet because it's a whole new function and you have to create systems and operations and also kind of a team environment. And then you get to the third phase where then, like you said, it's like all of a sudden maybe you're managing people who don't even work in restaurant. And that's something that I really struggle a lot with, right? Because I was good at managing people in the restaurant because I did all the stuff. I knew how to do all the stuff, and I could teach and coach and all those things. I don't know how to manage a marketing person, right? Or someone that's doing I'm pretty good at the bookkeeping, but I, you know, the financials and stuff. I mean, you start to manage these different types of roles in a very small office. That's a whole new type of leadership, right? You give someone feedback and you have to sit at the desk with them for the rest of the day, right? It's just a very different dynamic to get used to. And it's challenging, but every stage, you have to continue to hone your leadership skills and leadership voice, you know.
I think I can add a little more to the conversation here, because I think my journey is a little different. I have a engineering background, so in this restaurant I have a partner who's more on the culinary side. So I came in not working directly on the culinary side. So I was more working on like marketing, kind of growing the business, you know, like Jung said. And then I think when COVID hit, you know, in the last few years, I guess I realized that in order to be a leader, we really have to lead by example. So it's not like, okay, I work on those, you know, like big picture. I mean, yes, vision is important, but at the same time, if you have a small team you have to manage, you just have to show by example and then set a high standard. And that's just a hard work day in and day out until you can find some good manager that you can delegate the work to. I guess for me, you know, it's kind of the journey is kind of a little reversed, but I'm glad that, you know, it's better late than never. So I think now, coming out of COVID, we are in a much better shape to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does growth look like? I mean, excuse me, growth is hard. Growth is really challenging, especially in the environment that we're in right now with labor shortages, with supply chain issues. I mean, what does growth look like for all of you guys?
Growth is very scary because most people don't know how to grow a company, because when you have money, it's so difficult to really spend it right. So my experiences, I had 5 stores before COVID. Now I have, during COVID, shut 3 of them, 2.
It's the exact same. If we went from 5 to 2.
Same here, 5 to 2. That's why you put together this panel, I guess.
So that's almost second one. It's the first step side. I don't know how to cook. I just think, oh, there's a big vision we can do. And I some big team with a big burns to do something like Chinese food in the bit. Do this, raise a lot of money, do all these kind of fancy stuff. But in the meanwhile, just because the leadership doesn't have enough skills to become into the details of the company, then there's a lot of little things we never care about. We have a fast growth. But now when growth becomes stagnant, everything starts to pop up, like, oh, there's a problem we never saw before. Start to squeeze them out, right? We shrink the team from 20 people in our head to 6. Mm. At one moment, I remember I have 9 people from Yale in my team. I'm from Yale, so I have a lot of people from my team. So, like, this is totally overkill for
overqualified.
Right? It's like
or underqualified for the work you had on doing.
Exactly. Or overqualified is the way they think about it, email wise, right?
Yeah.
But definitely, like, that. We changed a lot and came back to a lot of restaurant operations. And I started cooking during COVID because nothing else to do. And offering restaurant work as a staff shift to know more about what I do. I reopened this new restaurant, new concepts, and started with World Fractions. And now to go back to fundraising. Now, like, compared to 3 years ago, running around fundraising, I know way more stuff than I do before, right? That's like a shrinkage of my sales revenue, but I think the company grew up from 20 people to 6, but the capacity-wise, skill set-wise, and spirit-wise, we grew a lot. I have way more confidence than before as a company, leaders.
Yeah, I mean, growing now. So we had actually really four going into the pandemic. We had five. We closed one right before the pandemic, unrelated to pandemic. And then another one, the deal just ended. So we actually really only closed one for pandemic. The other one would have closed because they're in the central business district areas where worker, you know, right. office workers work.
Yeah.
And even now, it's never going to quite be the same. Maybe you get three and a half days people at the office. Like, it's different than 5 day parts, right? So I think to us, growth looks like how it did maybe like in 2015 or 16, where we want to get out into the suburbs where you have office parks, but also lots of residential, easy parking. Right now, all of our locations are urban area, Washington, D.C., and I love the city life and the city feeling, but I think that there's limitations when you don't have all the office that you need. And then obviously you have parking issues where everyone has to be on foot, so you're serving a smaller area. The idea for going franchising, I mean, we look, I mean, we've been in business 12 years and we've done bank loans, organic growth, and but to get a lot of money, I don't want the pressure to open like, hey, go sign five leases in the next year, and like then we're going to three of the leases aren't going to be good because we're like, oh, well, we better take this one. I'd rather empower a franchisee to, like, get the lease deal that they want. We can pressure them, but we're not going to pressure them. We want to do franchising, right? Be like, hey, like, let's wait till you get the location you're comfortable with, that we're comfortable with, and then we'll help. Something during the pandemic when I was a little bit less busy is I was thinking, oh, I'd love to do some consulting. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, maybe I should consult, like, for my own business. That's kind of like franchising, right? Yeah. So it's kind of the thought process we had. So, yeah.
I think growth for our brand is to really figure out and then fine-tune the formula that we have, you know, kind of, you know, what kind of location and, you know, who are the customers that we're really targeting, you know, who would appreciate the value that we provide to them. And also, you know, kind of operationalize, how do we make sure that, and, you know, kind of, I'm on the same page with Mike, you know, because we're thinking about franchising as well. So in order to be able to franchise well, you have to have a very, very simplified operation.
It's all system.
Yeah. Right, a system, yes, yes. And that's something that we did not have, you know, kind of process. Again, just a very detailed things, you know, kind of checklist, right? Yes. New staff onboarding, so very, very detailed things, but you want to have a very, very comprehensive guide and a standard. Actually, you know, it's very, very critical to have a high standard. I guess, you know, until we can get that polished, we don't want to, like, just kind of grow, you know, without the blueprint. So that's what we're working on, to just really get a foundation solid.
There's a lot of brands that, and this is my own personal judgment, right? It's like not right or wrong. I mean, I think it's kind of wrong. When brands that are, you know, grow so fast that they just kind of lose control. So we actually have good training material, stuff like that over the years, but we have never done franchising before. So, you know, the idea that we also have to support the franchisee. So I'm in the same position as you at the franchising stage where, like, if we had five opening at once, I could do it, but, like, I wouldn't do as good of a job,
right?
So, like, maybe, like, two or three, and then, like, build a team around that, and then going stronger. Because, you know, especially you see some of these franchise companies, and they get in with some of the franchise salespeople, and it's like opening, you know, 100 units or something in 3 or 4 years, and it's it makes it very challenging.
Right.
I mean, maybe someone can make an exit, but, like, other than that, it's not a great restaurant.
Yeah.
So.
Is there anything else you guys want to talk about? Anything else you guys that's on your mind that you want to get off your chest about the restaurant industry before we end this conversation?
You said that the 30% less Chinese restaurants in the U.S. through the pandemic?
Yeah. 5 years, not through the pandemic.
Okay.
There's a long-term decline in Chinese neighbors right now.
Is it all due to labor force, or do you think it's the market?
Well, pandemic doesn't help. But that now means most of the Chinese restaurants don't lose too much sales.
Yeah.
They actually lose more labor. So the owners have to work in the pandemic because it's kind of hard labor. So that's at some point, it's just like, that's it. I'm told for this.
Right. And the next generation doesn't want to work restaurant.
Yeah, the Cheng restaurant design, that's the grinding, paper grinding machine. The Chinese food sell cheap, but that's because it's efficient. It's because they sell the labor cheap.
Yeah.
The food is very complicated. It's more complicated than a lot of fast food.
Oh, yeah.
A fast food price, right? So, as a result, Chinese people work, like, conditioned to work, they take one day off per year. That's how they make Chinese food everywhere. It's so cheap. And that should be changed.
Yeah.
That should definitely be changed.
Yeah.
So even today, majority of Chinese restaurant workers in China restaurant, they work 6 days a week.
So if you had a restaurant that's paying more, like, whatever, $20-$22 an hour for a walk cook or line cook or whatever. You could do if you charge $22 for an entree.
No, right now, if the Chinese restaurant pricing still maintains this kind of $15 less per person.
Right.
So that's why Chinese food being so popular. It's good and cheap.
Yeah.
So when you cook, you order Chinese or pizza. It's basically the same thing.
Right, but pizza is actually cheap. Chinese food's not that cheap.
Exactly.
Like the ingredients.
But the Chinese food is cheap, right? The Chinese food is not made that cheap.
Right.
So the future, like, if you want to increase the price of 20, mm-hmm. then Chinese food become out of their own kind of utility values.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep the value of 15, but in the meantime, significant change labor structures.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, for example, you don't cut the vegetable in the head anymore. You don't wrap them in the head anymore. Right? You don't wrap the stuff. That can be done by machines. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I use the automated walks to replace a lot of traditional walks of labors.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use everybody, basically from non-Chinese.
Wow.
So a lot of technology is already ready in China. I hear Chinese will be stuck in the 80s, but China already 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
It's more advanced than here for most restaurants. From model, from machines, from all the automation. So, but most of here don't really know that.
All right.
We have this informational research to use leverage mm-hmm. to really change Chinese food from 1980s to 2020.
Yeah. 2030.
I guess I'm curious to understand, because I think Yong mentioned, you know, this opportunity that Chinese food will have in the U.S. market. But I see, Mike, you're running this kind of Korean fusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have a Korean heritage? Or
no, that was I don't. I might actually not have done this right now, how I did it 12 years ago. Okay. But no, I really
You saw the opportunity.
I saw opportunity in Korean food, which now is extremely trendy.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Gochujang is like one of the most popular upcoming ingredients.
Yeah, K-pop, right? Culture.
Yeah, exactly. But I saw the opportunity, it was street food at the time when we started food truck.
Right.
And
Roy Choi.
Yeah, Roy Choi was the inspiration. Absolutely. He's still the inspiration. I still watch all of his shows and stuff. I like him. I don't know him, but but he's very impressive. And and yeah, we did our own thing and small business, and it wasn't on the East Coast that much at the time. So, but Korean food is delicious. It's also, in my observation, like, you know, breaking down. I mean, American food is changing so much.
Yeah.
Obviously, American food is a melting pot. I mean, even Chinese food in the cities. Well, lots of places you're seeing more like regional Chinese restaurants.
Yes.
That's representing whatever, Hunanese, Sichuan, whatever, you know, stuff that when I was growing up, I didn't know that existed.
Right.
I mean, it's even the same as in Mexican food, you know, it's highly regional, highly complex, from what like we understand or I understood as Mexican food. And Korean, I think the first wave was like Korean barbecue. It's like sugar and soy sauce. Americans like that. But now it's getting to the next level where fermented paste, the jangs and different things are
wings.
And but even like, and we don't serve this, but even like the soups, like the GAs and stuff like that are becoming more and more popular. And I think that over time that happens. And that's why I'm concerned about the price point with Chinese food, particularly. And like Mexican, El Salvadorian food, like different things we have in my hometown, that the price point is remaining too cheap because it's unrealistically cheap. And, you know, you serve a ravioli at an Italian restaurant, you can make a lot more than you can make a beautiful dumpling with the same ingredients. So I hope that can change, but I don't know exactly when people's perceptions will shift on the value of that food.
I think people just have to have the money to pay.
Well, there's that too. There's that too.
I think that's what all of us have in common is we see the opportunities in Asian food here in the U.S. Mm. I guess I've been thinking about, you know, is there really a demand, right? Mm. How do we validate? Do we have data? I mean, you know, kind of we are small restaurants, right? We don't really have that much data to kind of back it up. I mean, it's more like
that's
a
right.
gut. It's like a gut.
Okay. Yeah, you got
to. We're actually like hiring programmers to grab data from you.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. That's reassuring, I guess.
Yeah, it is reassuring. Yeah, it's very interesting, all this. In Texas, you're in Austin.
Yeah, okay. It's a good town.
Yeah.
You know? Fusion food. Mm-hmm. Very foodie culture in general. So,
Asian food is on rice because there's so much more Asian culture stuff being produced.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also the economic influence from Asia is getting more and more just trading. And one reason that there's more Chinese restaurants in this city, because Chinese restaurants closed from 46,000 to, I mean, there's only 23,000 still stays in 5 years. There's a reopening of 12,000.
Right.
So that 12,000 opened to a lot of new demographics. The younger generation, so Chinese, like Chinese immigrant recent immigrants, they can afford the more expensive Chinese food with more quality, diversity, everything. Mm-hmm. So in the city, they actually depend on these people to be able to support the price change. So you can find a lot of the regions have more authentic Chinese food. That's one big reason, because there's so much Chinese students in the past 10 years. About 30%. Chinese students are the largest international student pool. They all pay full tuitions. Actually support public schools here. So that's because China is growing so fast the past 20 years because of the WTO. So it's all kind of connected, right? And now we see today is... It's an interesting time. It's time that decoupling, the time of deglobalization. But meanwhile, a lot of things still keep pushing forward, such technologies and the growth of the minority kind of voices here. But I think Chinese restaurant is the largest like Asian food entities or establishment in the U.S. But Korean, Japanese food also big, but Korean food on rice and also Asian food on rice. But a lot of them is driven by the immigrants. So Japanese food, unfortunately right now, because Japanese immigrants, there are not too many of them anymore. A lot of, majority of opening new Japanese restaurants are opened by Chinese or other Asian.
Right. Yep.
So, but still, opening Asian food really there need to be more people, non-Asian people, to open Asian food.
We need more mics.
Well, do you have a mostly Chinese labor or
no? All of our labor are a lot of Latinos actually.
We have mostly Latino and Black folk and we've had a couple of Korean employees actually that were in college. It was,
Well, labor is a whole other issue to touch on. We could really get deep into the weeds, but I feel like we touched on some really important issues that we got into.
Yeah.
And I feel like we got some really important cultural discussions talked about that I'm really happy we got into. So thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Holly, for the invitation.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, appreciate it.
It's great.
Yeah.